how can we actually build those skills within educators, within the classroom, to actually transform their own, you know, classroom pedagogy to be more driven by student voice, more global, more technology infused.
And welcome back again, everyone, to the Modern Learners Podcast. I'm Will Richardson, and that voice you just heard was that of Michael Furtick, who is the founder, co-founder of Taking It Global, which is an amazing organization that is connecting classrooms and evolving pedagogy and practice to focus on sustainability and social justice. And in this podcast episode, Michael and my good friend and colleague Bruce Dixon talk for about 35 minutes about Michael's work to change what's happening in schools and also some of the challenges and opportunities that technology brings to solving some of the world's biggest problems. Really great that you're here listening once again to our podcast. As you all know, we are also the co-founders of modernlearners.com, Change School, and now the Change Leaders Community, which is our newest effort at trying to expand the conversation around change in schools. Really want to invite you to check it out. It's changeleaders.community. Nice, easy URL to remember. Have a look. We're going to be doing a lot of work to build capacity for all types of leaders at every level to engage in this really important and much needed conversation around high bar change in schools. We're going to have lots of coaching sessions and curated readings and guest speakers and just a whole bunch of stuff that we know that you're going to enjoy. Our new community manager, Lynn Hilt, is already hard at work developing all that. And it's going to be a great experience if you check it out. So we hope you do that. But for now, sit back and relax and listen to this really interesting conversation about what classrooms could be in a world that is changing very quickly and that is facing a whole bunch of challenges, but is also rife with opportunity for our students. Enjoy, everyone. Thanks for listening.
It's a real pleasure to have a friend and colleague, Michael Furtick, who's one of the co-founders now, Director of Innovation at Taking Global, based up in Toronto. And I've known Michael for quite a time, but as much as we talk about your work at Taking It Global, maybe for people who haven't come across Taking It Global to date, if you don't mind, can you take us back a little bit, talk about how this all got started and what your grounding were for the organization?
Yeah, so this is year 17. So it was, I was in my last year of high school, and the kind of founding, I guess, opportunity or thesis was that technology could be used more effectively to drive student engagement on one hand. And on the other hand, there were these millennium development goals that were being set out for the world to say, you know, we need to address the social challenges that face our countries. And so we saw an opportunity to really launch a web-based platform and a global online community that would help students from around the world really get connected around real-world problem solving. The kind of mission statement was empowering young people to understand and act on the world's greatest challenges. So we, you know, that's been a journey for the last 17 years. Obviously, there's still a long way to go on some of those issues, but, you know, it didn't take long for us to realize, and I think my invitation to your conference and Lauren in that first year really helped us realize that there was huge opportunity, not just in reaching young people directly, but in partnering with teachers and classrooms to bring these ideas and to bring, you know, new technologies and the internet into their classrooms as a tool for global competency, really.
So that was 17 years ago. And today?
Well, I think if anything, the opportunity and the need and the awareness of this work is more prevalent than ever. Now that the OECD, you know, about a year ago, released this, you know, global competencies for an inclusive world framework. And now with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, where they've, you know, really focused not just on the developing world, but the developed world too, I think that educators around the world are realizing the need and opportunity to, you know, bring their classrooms in contact with one another for global learning and understanding. As of, I think, this coming year, the OECD is going to start piloting global competencies in PISA, looking at things like students' attitudes towards immigration, their participation in, you know, social justice movements and social action and behavior change. So obviously they say, and they've said for a long time, what gets measured matters. So now that this is becoming more measurable and in the policy statements and visions of more schools, more governments, there's more demand for the work than ever. And so that's why we're trying to go from just, you know, serving individual educators to serving systems. And now we're really thinking more about, you know, systems of systems. How can we really grow beyond our own capacity as a small organization? And, you know, we have about 32 staff now, which is in some ways large, but in some ways tiny compared to the scope of the reach we're trying to have. So we're trying to really adopt an approach of sharing as much as we can about our, you know, our curriculum, our methodology, our learning, both, you know, in reaching on people directly and educators, to share those models for professional learning and for classroom collaboration to become as open as possible.
And within that time, no doubt, you know, you've had a lot of learning about how to connecting to people. I think maybe you could give everyone a little bit of a sense about the reach that you have. What are the metrics about the people that you're connecting with, both young people and schools and systems?
Sure. So we now reach schools in 154 countries. There's about...
Is that all?
Well, there's about 5,700. So it's not tens of thousands or millions, but it's 5,700 schools that have registered and signed up and, you know, educators from across the planet, about 16,000 teachers that are kind of active users of our platform, our tools, our resources, and contributors as well. I mean, the great thing about everything we do is that, you know, there's no cost and there's no registration required. So we've got, you know, the lesson plans and resources and educational games, for example, are some of the most popular parts of our site. And I think for us, it's really about how we can support now projects and collaborations that are transformative for students. So really not just sharing resources that educators download, but how can we actually build those skills within educators, within the classroom, to actually transform their own, you know, classroom pedagogy to be more driven by student voice, more global, more technology infused. So, you know, in addition to all these online resources we've built and offered for many years, most recently, over the last 3 years, we've been working on building a graduate level course for teachers that we most recently this year ran for 6 districts across Ontario, about 40 independent schools in the US, and about a dozen countries in Eastern Europe, to really build capacity within educators to design these kind of projects on their own. Because ultimately, if they're dependent on us and they're coming to us saying, what's next for my classroom? You know, that's great, but it's not really sustainable. So I think our next great challenge is how can we build and share and scale that capacity in every educator to feel confident in building global collaborations, to feel comfortable with a variety of technologies, and to really feel, you know, confident that they can unleash their students' ideas into the classroom. Because I think ultimately the biggest driver of student engagement will be students themselves participating in the design of their learning.
So in that brief response, you've sort of encapsulated some fairly big ideas that I'd really like to dig down into. And if I can just say to people listening and watching that we will share with you, obviously, with the post, the links that you've been mentioning. You should also mention, now, what's the best way to take, I know we can go to Taking It Global either by takingitglobal.org or TIGWEB, TIGWEB.org. Is that right?
Yep. And then there's a link that says for educators on every page that leads to TIGED or Taking It Global for Educators, which is where the community resources, projects database and platform are. So, you know, at the heart of it, there's also a free collaboration platform, which is almost like an LMS designed for collaboration, which was actually one of the first things we built because we realized that, especially at the K-12 level, most of the tools that exist were locked down within a school or within a district. So we built one of the world's first kind of free, open, collaborative LMSs to enable these kind of projects to happen. And that's still something we offer teachers for free.
So let's dig into some of those ideas that you were just talking about earlier. And obviously student agency is a big one, but let's go back a little bit higher. The initiative you're talking about in terms of the graduate level program, is that referring to the Future Friendly Schools program?
Our professional learning for teachers. So Future Friendly Schools is almost at the very top. So we've established that there's 3 values that we think are kind of essential for student engagement. And those are global citizenship or global competency, student voice, and environmental stewardship is a particular issue of urgency and interest with climate change on the horizon. And with those 3 values, we think there's these kind of key approaches of the immersive use of technology and project-based learning, or, you know, we're talking about it now as almost like social innovation. So not just projects, but projects with a particular focus on social change. And I think when you look at, you know, ultimately what governments are counting on the education system to do, we're talking about, you know, sustainable livelihoods. How can we ensure that everyone exiting the education system has employment and is able to contribute in a positive way to society? And I think that for us, we're really trying to foster a theme and an understanding and an excitement around social entrepreneurship as an outcome for students, whether they decide to pursue a career and they're able to infuse social innovation entrepreneurship in a large company or in a government, or whether they launch their own initiative or enterprise. We want them to think about that from a social point of view. And it's important to think about because here in Canada, we all think that, you know, the energy sector drives jobs and it is a big contributor, but in fact, the nonprofit sector is a bigger employer than the energy sector. And so can we, you know, what kind of opportunities can we create by unleashing young people to work on these big global challenges, either in their communities or in the world? I think that's really going to be the future economic growth because, you know, the factory jobs, manufacturing, we're talking here in North America about where Amazon's next headquarters is going to be in. All the cities in North America are fighting over it. But, you know, there's a great piece in our national newspaper over the weekend saying we should be focused instead on how we cultivate the next Amazon because, you know, these incentives that they're expecting from cities and tax breaks and things and all these facts, they're not sustainable. They're, you know, you're barely breaking even in many cases on the jobs you're buying. And so, you know, fostering this next generation of innovation and next YouTubes, next Amazons and Facebooks, I think that's really going to be critical. And with the global challenges that we face, I think those initiatives coming from an environmental and social lens is critically important.
So you talked about the notion of, you know, social entrepreneurship, you know, offering more jobs than, you know, traditional sectors, but it's also not mutually exclusive, is it? I mean, you want people who, you know, may not necessarily go 100% down that path, but also basically everybody should have a social awareness and some commitment to social, making a social contribution. And certainly I would have thought the opportunity you're providing to students and teachers are resources, ideas, prompts, provocations that will help them think differently about the directions or choices they're making. Would you agree?
Yeah, and helping the companies they end up working for do the same. I mean, I think that's exactly right. It's not that everyone needs to start a charity. Entrepreneurship in most cases is for profit. But even when you work at a large company, you know, one of the founders of an organization that started around the same time as ours ended up going to work for Walmart. And he kind of engineered a massive move at Walmart towards green energy and towards, you know, LEDs, for example. And it wasn't primarily because it was good for the planet. It was primarily because it saved a huge amount of money and it happened to also be good for the environment. So being able to communicate, to find these opportunities and for students to partner with local businesses, local organizations and help them solve these challenges with a social point of view, I think is also a much more valuable, you know, co-op placement or work experience than sweeping the floors or photocopying used to be when you think of co-op. So, you know, a big part of our work with teachers is helping them think about community partnerships, which are often overlooked in the public school system, especially. And how can we actually, you know, have students begin to become assets and partners to local nonprofits or local businesses to bring in and infuse the classroom with those real world challenges that we know drive learning and drive engagement.
So when you talk about those sorts of, what sort of, can you give an example of the sorts of partnerships or an example of one of the partnerships that you've seen grow and how that's been developed by the school?
Yeah, I mean, here in the TDS, in the Toronto District School Board, we had about 40 different teachers from about a dozen different schools, all working with different local nonprofits. And part of that really depended on the subject and grade level they taught. So, for example, you know, there was a high school math class that went and looked at the transit system and used, you know, what they were learning about math algorithms to propose a whole new system of, you know, transit fares and accessibility for that. There was an elementary school class that wanted to raise awareness about, you know, the huge explosion in condominiums, which I'm sitting in right now, and the effect that, you know, design principles have on the life of birds. So they partnered with a local nonprofit called FLAP, which actually has developed a whole new technology for windows that actually prevents birds crashing into them and being killed. And so they did a whole awareness campaign for them and working with their parents. And then even looking internally at the school district, there was a group of students that looked at, you know, plastic water bottles, which it's hard to believe people still use in this day and age. And the challenge they saw when they kind of audited their school and the parent community is that students actually didn't have an easy way to refill reusable water bottles in the school. And so they lobbied and successfully convinced the superintendent to actually invest in a water bottle refill station at their school to allow them to ban plastic water bottles and refill them. So whether it's, you know, a broader social challenge or something very specific to the school, I think there's huge opportunities for partnerships. And we've tried to model, to share those models by building this projects repository on the TIGED site, which we can link to after, that highlights, I think we're at now about 475 projects that are now kind of showcasing those examples like those.
So 475 is a heck of a bank of library of ideas and projects. I think that what you highlighted with those examples was the scope of where you're going with the ideas. So some of them are the big issues. Some of them are the big issues that people, I think sometimes teachers, others can be critical and say, well, why are you trying to get the, you know, kids to solve world poverty? It's a problem that's way beyond them. But I think what you're highlighting is there are ways they can take pieces of these big issues and address them in very substantial and worthwhile ways and make the contribution in addition to the plastic bottles. And so there seems to be a range of potential of which you're reaching out to.
Right. And at the high end, when we're talking in, at the high school level, there's a even much more sophisticated dialogue for students to get involved in. Just last week, we kicked off this year's version of our COP dialogue. So every year, the United Nations has a climate change conference called COP, which is the follow-up to the, you know, original climate summit. And for years, we've been engaging, you know, larger and larger groups of students. This year, we're up to about 25 schools from 18 countries as kind of the core lead school group. And these are students collaborating across every continent and every time zone to develop kind of a position paper and a reflective paper on behalf of kind of the students in their countries that they will actually travel to Germany and present as part of the United Nations conference, working this year with UNESCO, with UNICEF, with UN FCCC, which is the secretariat for that conference. So we're looking both at, you know, the local level and water bottle refill stations, all the way up to presenting, you know, global student opinions, representing over 100,000 students to the United Nations at the official conferences and summits. So we're obviously trying to make this accessible from the kindergarten level all the way up to high school, where we partner the students with graduate students at universities to kind of mentor them in this writing process. And then we end up facilitating a student from each of these schools to travel to the conference and actually be part of that presentation. So imagine that compared to, you know, the Model UN experience where they're just making it up.
So I could ask how do you have the capacity to do this, but I realize you do have a staff. Is it 250 now you've got working for you? No, sorry, I was exaggerating. So people who are listening, I happen to have a ridiculous respect for Michael and Jennifer and their team's capacity, because listening to this, you've got to be thinking, how on earth can they do all this? And we're only just touching on the very surface of the work that you're doing. And I am trying to highlight the fact that whilst a lot of these ideas can appear overwhelming and even a little bit intimidating to teachers who may be listening, you know, you've made them very accessible. So I'm a teacher in a country somewhere in the world. I'm not in Canada. I'm in Australia or New Zealand. And I want to get involved in some of these projects. What should I do?
Well, I think the easiest way to get started is just to browse the database of projects, look at your subject area or your grade level. Don't get too specific with the filters, but just get inspired by things that other people have done. I think the most important thing is actually not to take one of these ideas off the shelf and try to insert it. But I think the best place to start is actually to look at the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. You know, show your students one of those videos and ask them, you know, what issue do you care about? What issue do you want to do something about this year? And really to work with them to see how that can, you know, how they can meet the expectations of your curriculum while addressing that issue. And that in a nutshell is what our process is all about. Now, we obviously infuse our courses and our platform with lots of support around that. But essentially, it's about exposing students to different social challenges, helping them understand, you know, what they need to learn within the curriculum, and letting them kind of take shared ownership over that with you and being more of a guide. Just back to your point for a second about the amount of things we do with the team we have. I think one of the reasons why it's possible is that we have a few key partnerships with districts like Edmonton Public, for example, where that decarbonized program is run out of, where they actually provide release time for one of their teachers to collaborate with us to deliver that program. So even as a district, you know, for those people listening who might be district leaders or principals or superintendents, I think you have a huge opportunity with the people that you have to actually foster innovation by just giving, you know, some key innovators in your school, not more responsibility, not more to do, but actually investing in a little bit of space for them to be creative and them to, you know, share their ideas with others and plan and design something. Because that's really how all these collaborative video projects got started. It was a teacher in Edmonton who had a great vision for it. He had a bit of time from his district, and now it's a program that serves the whole district and the world because he has, you know, half of his day supported to do that. So even within a district context, I think there's a lot of untapped potential in our district to take many of the ideas that are maybe right now just packed away in one school and take them to the district or take them global. Yeah. And not just, you know, having one class benefit.
Yeah. So So let's talk a little bit more about capacity and agency, because that's a common theme across what you're talking, and you're trying to help, because I think we all know the challenge that I think a lot of teachers find with this notion about project-based or inquiry-based learning, that it, you know, where do you start? How do you oversee it? You know, and how do you grant students genuine agency in the process, or enable genuine agency in that process, without it being a trivialization of the concept that you actually do have student-driven inquiry, and that does enable them to go deeper into the projects that they want to engage in.
Yeah, I think depending on the age level, there's lots of options, whether it's, you know, deciding what issue they want to work on, whether it's co-designing the assessment, whether it's deciding what kind of media or what format they're going to present in. So obviously you probably won't be able to allow them to have voice in every aspect of the process, but just starting maybe with the beginning and letting them pick the issue, or letting them participate in the assessment, or letting them choose, you know, whether it's they're going to build a website or present a video, or, you know, I think that there's opportunities at every stage of the process, and it's not that every single box has to be checked. But I think that whatever flexibility you do have, there's definitely opportunities, I think, for everyone to introduce that concept of student agency at voice at any age group. And I'm just reading this PBL book that I'm about to give my son's teacher by Dana Lohr. And it's talking about that at the kindergarten level. You know, how can you expose them to authentic opportunities and challenges really at any grade? So, yeah, I think there's lots of great resources out there about it on the internet as well, depending on your age group. But I think it just begins with asking them a question about what, you know, the question we ask is, if you could change one thing in your school, community, country, or the world, what would it be? And just starting with that as a class discussion, as a, you know, mind map, and then going, and then you can align that brainstorm with a structure like the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals that has tons of classroom resources and tools. And there's a whole platform called the World's Largest Lesson that the UN has built to support that.
And I think you're giving people now some structure, a bit of framework that they can look to. Can you talk a little bit then about the teachers, graduate teacher program you're talking about, the course? Because I think people, if we understand, you know, that framework, and understand there are a lot of resources there we can link people to, but how do you support them in that work? Pedagogically, a lot of teachers aren't familiar with an inquiry-based environment. How can you help them in that, and how do you sort of support that work?
Yeah, the way that we've designed it is basically the course takes place across six sessions. So there's a full day in-person kickoff. There's four half-day sessions throughout the school year. And at the end of the year, there's a bit of a kind of showcase, whether it's in-person or virtual, depending on the nature of the course, where students actually present back their learning, and educators get to step back and celebrate. And so I think that was one of the key learnings for us, is that, you know, you can't do this all in a day or a week or a weekend of PD. It actually has to be just in time, because these projects take time to design. So, you know, our first virtual session is about exploring possibilities, you know, helping students through that design process. Then we look at tools for social innovation. You know, what are all the technology tools, and also, you know, resources, things like the, you know, stakeholder maps, or, you know, pitch decks. Then we look at refining your focus. So, you know, actually picking and developing the project, and then growing momentum, you know, evaluation, fundraising, and all those kinds of things. So the way that we've iterated and built on the course is really now delivering it, you know, throughout the year to support educators in that project design process. And we moved from offering it to individual educators, anyone could just sign up, now offering it really only at the systems level, where a district will come in and say, okay, we're going to have, you know, a minimum of 30 teachers, and ideally 2 to 3 per school, because we learned that if it's just a single person at a school, that you really miss that opportunity for collaboration across subjects and grades. And we're also very open now to, you know, sharing the entire course. You know, one of our goals is, how can this be sustained without us driving it? So a train the trainer model, where we might work with a district to, you know, transfer that process, that course, and for a district or a school to run it internally. We're now exploring that with a few districts that are interested, because, you know, as a small organization, our mandate is far beyond just, you know, there's 500 schools in Toronto. We could spend a whole decade just working through those. So we really want to try to move to that systems of systems. So we're very keen to partner with, you know, larger districts, or with organizations serving many districts, to customize this and really scale this further without necessarily keeping ownership of it. We want to be open about it. So
now you've mentioned Canadian schools a fair bit, and I think you probably, if you could just explain a little bit, that obviously a lot of your work happens outside Canada. How do you manage those sorts of courses outside Canada?
Yeah, so outside of Canada, they're mainly delivered virtually. We've had the opportunity in Eastern Europe to partner with a whole cluster of international schools across about a dozen countries. And that actually involved an in-person orientation where they came together. Then we did the virtual session, and then it was actually an in-person showcase at the end. In the U.S., with the network of schools there, we worked with mostly independent schools. That was completely virtual. We even had a virtual student showcase at the end. So one of the things for us is that, you know, as a charity, we're not a sales organization. We don't have any sales reps. And so we're very responsive in terms of, you know, word of mouth, people coming to us, building partnerships through other nonprofits. So we haven't really worked with any large districts in the U.S. or in other countries, just because of the cycles involved in, you know, selling that isn't something we've had the bandwidth to engage in. But it's not to say we're not interested. We can just only do so much. So we're keen to continue to share the syllabus that we built, and the fact that it's been validated at the graduate level for teachers to earn credit, I think also, you know, shows something about the kind of comprehensive nature of the learning that we've structured.
And I presume that if, for instance, you had a serious inquiry from a large system in another country, be it across Africa or New Zealand or wherever, and they wanted to do the train the trainer and take that within their own country, you'd be very interested to talk to them at that level.
Definitely. And it's also been evaluated both here in Ontario and internationally. We were able to present a kind of closing keynote panel after Michael Fullan's talk this year at the International Conference on School Effectiveness and Improvement, following a presentation last year at the Ontario Education Research Summit. So this has actually been independently studied by Toronto District School Board's research unit. They designed an evaluation structure, and there were some really great results in terms of, you know, the number of educators who'd recommend this learning, the number who intend to transfer and apply it immediately in their practice, you know, it's the number who thought was relevant to their school improvement plans. So there's some great data behind it as well that should support adoption.
So if people are interested in following up on that, obviously we'll put the links in there again, but we'll put your email link for people who may look at wanting to inquire at the systemic level. But certainly at individual teacher, educator level, or school, they can make the link directly through the website. Is that right?
Yeah. And we've got some great videos we can link to that kind of showcase what this looks like from the student's perspective. We've been lucky to be able to capture that both in Europe and here in Ontario.
And a little bit, just if we can, just in sort of coming to a close, is talk a little bit maybe about some of the big projects, or not the big projects, but some of the really significant projects that you've had schools involved in. I know Deer Forest Action was one that you're involved with over a number of years, either that or some others that you've actually worked with over a period of time that you think's had a real impact.
Yeah, I mean, one of our big focus areas right now, which I think is interesting to highlight, is really trying to support Indigenous reconciliation and education here in Canada. So we had the opportunity to take over a program about 3 years ago that was founded by Cisco in three schools in Nunavut, which is our most northern province. And we've now grown it as of this month to 31 remote schools, really representing the 1% of Canada that's not connected. And for us, we're really trying to take a thoughtful approach to designing, you know, interactive, high-definition learning experiences that really bring, you know, Indigenous values and culture and content to life. So we're challenging ourselves with that. I think it's an opportunity to look at collaboration from a different point of view. You know, what is collaboration like when you don't have access to the internet, but you might have, you know, a video conversation like this? How can you actually address the huge dropout rates, the really appalling and shocking suicide rates, you know, one of the highest in the world when you look at our northern provinces? And I think it's really trying to foster that sense of hope in students that is lacking globally. You know, that I think we remember that old data point. It hasn't been really updated, but only 14% of students around the world feel like the world is becoming a better place. That was a BBDO study about a decade ago. And then there has been more recent data from Gallup that showed the link between hope and success in higher education and success in life. And so I think really what it comes down to is fostering that sense of hope. And that's really, I think, consistent through all of our projects, whether it be our social innovation camps and resources for students, this Connected North work in our Indigenous communities, a project like Deforest Action, which is really trying to get students to feel like they can make a difference on a complex issue like illegal deforestation through lobbying, through fundraising, through, you know, advocacy work, and through travel and deeper understanding. So for us, I think the kind of common thread through a lot of these programs is really trying to support students in having hope when you're confronted with these complex global challenges, and realizing that every action does make a difference, and trying to build experiences for them to see the local to global connection. And I think it's especially important because often with these sustainable development goals, these millennium goals, people think, oh, that's over there. You know, we need to fix that problem in Africa, in, you know, Asia, wherever it is. But actually, you look at Canada, we're the world's biggest per capita consumer of water and producer of garbage, right alongside the U.S. And so there's a lot of work we have to do at home on these issues in terms of, you know, responsible consumption and production, in terms of, you know, life below land, life below water and things like that. And so I think it's important to reflect back on the role we have, not just in global competencies and the other, but in the local effects and local causes that contribute to these global issues that we're all responsible for.
And you'd see this, though, as something that can engage young people at all ages, wouldn't you? I mean, you mentioned that the fact that you're working at very early ages. I mean, this isn't something we just give to 16 to 18-year-old students. This is something that you've had people across all age groups working in these various areas.
Yeah, I think you might remember with Deforest Action that it was actually primarily elementary schools driving it.
Yeah.
Many years ago, there was a Roper study that looked at social issues over ages, and I actually found the peak of interest in social issues was around the grade 6-7 level. And then it kind of...
Which falls. Is 11 to 13-year-olds.
Yeah. So it's kind of this magic moment where, you know, you're building up their awareness and interest. And if you don't do something with it, if you don't leverage it, if you don't engage them, and I think it's such an opportunity to deeply engage them in their learning, the majority of those students become disengaged. And even the most recent data here in Canada shows the majority of high school students are not intellectually engaged and don't, you know, aren't particularly engaged in their school experience. So they might be graduating at higher rates than ever, and there's many reasons for that, but I think there's a huge potential that's lost. And when you reflect back on the last few centuries of human development, you know, the majority of the innovations that we take for granted today were created by young people. You know, we didn't used to live that long. And so I put the boat on a huge potential for innovation and problem solving if we don't hook them early and give them opportunities to, you know, really dig into those challenges to form the next generation of entrepreneurs and innovators.
So just to finish, I guess, just a really pragmatic question. You know, maybe I've been listening to what we've been talking about, and I'm a teacher, I teach grade 6, I teach year 11, 12. But, you know, what about the teacher who's sort of still saying, well, how do I fit this into my existing curriculum? You know, that really pragmatic, I know I've got existing constraints. You know, are there ways that you talk with them about making this possible in a broader sense across a broad range of subject domains? I mean, how do you go about answering that question?
Yeah, I think that, and when they look at our projects page, when they look at our resources, there's projects literally in every single subject area. I think part of the unique, the magic of what can happen with student voice is that when you turn over, when you give students some transparency on those objectives, what we've seen through many models, and it started, you remember the Reinventing Schools Coalition, the whole, you know, the model of giving students ownership and visibility into those standards or into those objectives that a teacher has to deal with, and let them do that mapping for you. Say to them, okay, you care about your problem. Well, you need to figure out and achieve these 5 learning goals by the end of the month. So figure out a way to do that and do something about your issue. And I think that the challenge, you know, it's often chaos, it's messy, but that's innovation. Entrepreneurship is messy. There's not a lot of exciting things that happen in a very orderly fashion in the world. So I think that it's important to expose students to that kind of chaos, because that's the reality of today's workplace. You know, things are not presented to them in a structured, organized way to solve problems. There's, you know, things flying at you all over the place, information overload and multiple sources. And so navigating that complexity, if you don't expose that to them early, I think they'll be overwhelmed by it and they won't be able to thrive.
Well, you've highlighted a topic for another podcast for another time, because actually in Change School this week, we're talking about the modern context for learning. And I think that is a challenge that we do have to, school has to represent and reflect the world in which our young people are moving into. And if we isolate them from it, they're going to be very poorly prepared. And I'd have to say, Michael, yourself and Jennifer and the work you do with your team is quite extraordinary. I find the biggest challenge I have when I talk to others around, teachers around the world about this, is they are overwhelmed by the work you're doing, by the extent that you're doing that work, you know, how deeply you're going and engaging with people like UNESCO and OECD, but at the same level, dealing with Indigenous kids in Northern Canada. And I think that, you know, at times people do find all that a little bit too much. And I think that hopefully what we're now doing in this podcast is explain to people the opportunity that all teachers and all students have from engaging in this work with you guys. I mean, you know, all power to the work that you've done. You've I think, created a different perspective for young people in the work that they're doing, and you've shown that it's possible for them to really make a difference, which has ultimately been your goal in taking it global. So congratulations again to you and Jennifer. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us. And I know we'll post all those links, and any queries people have got, feel free to contact Michael directly and he'll be able to support your work. So thanks very much, Michael.
Thanks, everyone. See you online.
Cheers.
So thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed that podcast. And Bruce and I will be back next week with another edition of the Modern Learners Podcast, with any luck. Until then, though, don't forget to stop on over to changeleaders.community, where we are putting together a global network, a global tribe of people who are interested in pushing that bar ever higher when it comes to thinking about and talking about and acting around what sustainable, relevant change looks like in classrooms for our kids. It's an interesting time, lots of interesting conversations, and lots of interesting opportunities to get involved and take part, and we hope to see you there. And finally, don't forget that our fourth cohort of Change School starts in January, and we are getting ready to crank that up and open up our registrations here in a few weeks. If you want to get more information, just go to change.school, fill in the form, and you'll be first to be notified when we start taking members for our, I can't believe it, but our fourth cohort already. It's an amazing experience that a lot of people are talking about and that we are learning a great deal from as we do it. So maybe you can be a part of that as well. But either way, thanks again for listening, everyone, and we will catch you again next week on the podcast. Take care.